The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
Hello. It works. So how long do I have to talk?
10:45.
Okay. Hi, you. Been a long time since I've been here. I think 10 years or more, maybe. Long time. Anyway, here now. Did I announce what I'm going to talk about? Oh. Okay. Huh? It will be. Anything. So I put together this set of notes on the archaeology of the heart, and it's really a map of the terrain of the heart as we really try to be here now. So if we actually took a kind of core sample of what it means to be here, and just really looked within ourselves, both with awareness, but also looked at where we are on the earth, and just went into this place where we are, what would we find? So that's what I want to talk about. Is that okay? Okay, who said that? Okay, just got to know who I'm talking to. Okay, so when the Buddha was asked why some people are wise and liberated and why other people are kind of dull and entangled in suffering, he said something to the effect that those who ask a lot of questions end up wise. And it's not the kind of questions that we ask of, you know, authorities or that we find answers for in the book, but it's those who ask questions of themselves, like, what's going on here? And that is really the whole task of mindful awareness, is to ask the question, what's this? What is this phenomenological experience that is being known at this time? And when we start this kind of practice and this kind of investigation, really, we can't help but start with what is known about ourselves. T.S. Eliot, in his little getting of the Four Quartets, kind of summarizes the whole journey of awakening in this way. We shall not cease from exploration, and the end of all of our exploring will be to arrive where we started and know the place for the first time. This journey that we're on doesn't go anywhere. It only stays right here. And there's everything that we need to learn is right here. And we start with this very obvious mind-body experience that we're having right now. And when we look at that in an ongoing way, we can't help but move deeper into what this mind-body continuum reveals. It takes more than a curious interest to sustain the effort and to be willing to engage the terrain of the heart that we will inevitably discover. And so it takes something of an intrepid state of mind that is not easily put off by boredom, the familiar, the unknown, the scary, and anything else that you'd rather not look at. So Carl Sagan one of my current teachers, says, avoidable human misery is more often caused not so much by stupidity as by ignorance, particularly ignorance about ourselves. And I think every one of us can confirm that. If you've sat and watched your mind for, 40 minutes as we just did, you can see. What we don't know about ourselves is really the source of a tremendous amount of suffering and carelessness in our lives. Yeah. Not because we're stupid, not because we're not even well-intentioned. It's because we don't really see, and what we don't see, we certainly don't understand. The whole task of mindfulness is to be here now. But it's interesting that the function, the function of our, of mindfulness, or the sati, the factor of mind of mindfulness, is to remember. The function of mindfulness is to remember. And we might ask, well, what is it that we're supposed to remember? I was doing a retreat, first retreat I did with Saito Upandita. It was a 3-month retreat at IMS in 1984, and had to check in with him every day, and I was having a hell of a time. It was a retreat for 20 people. They were all teachers, or people identified as going to be teachers, and me. I happened to be the executive director of IMS, so they just kind of let me in, not because I was a teacher or going to be a teacher, and far from it. But nobody told Upandita that. So I was following this one woman in my interviews, and we just would stand outside in the hallway while being interviewed, and the door was open, and this woman was one day, she was one of these, had a lot of beginner's luck. She just had amazing good mindfulness and was pretty dramatic in her expression of what she was noticing. So one day she was in giving a report, and she's just wildly exclaiming that she's remembering her past lives, and this life was doing this and that life, and it was so this and that. It's like, past lives, it's like, okay, right. Okay, so I'm standing in the hallway trying to find my breath, and when it was my turn, she came out, she's kind of floating down the hallway, just kind of like bouncing between lives, I guess. And so I walked into Upandita, kind of did my bows, and out of utter frustration and exasperation, I was like, what the hell am I doing? I just blurted out, what are we supposed to be doing here anyway, remembering our past lives or something? And he is unflappable. He just sits there and looks at me and says, no, remembering this life. That's what it's about. It's remembering this moment of this life right now. That's what mindfulness is. Remembering to recognize the present moment's experience. And if we can remember, which is the hardest part of mindfulness, then we can observe and know what's actually going on. But isn't that the hardest part? You close your eyes and you promptly forget what you're supposed to be doing. You know, you sit down with all good intention. I mean, you scheduled your day to come here. You sit down, and you've got every intention to be mindful. You close your eyes, and in 40 minutes, the bell rings. And you go, what was I supposed to be doing? And we're lost in thought. And when we do remember, we remember, oh, right. But now think about this. When you don't remember this present moment, the mind wanders off, right? It goes off into the past, into the future. It's commenting about this. It's solving that problem. It's strategizing how to get what you want. It's off doing something. And while the mind is off doing that, we don't know it. We don't know that's what the mind's doing. We don't know where we are. We don't know whether we're sitting, standing, walking, lying down. We don't know our gender, our age, our ethnic identity. We don't know a thing. Right? You don't know. You're totally lost. Except when you come back, or when you remember, or let's say mindfulness grabs you out of your fantasy life, you know, and you go click, oh, here I am. Sometimes you can remember everything you were just thinking about. But at the time, didn't remember. Right? You didn't know what was going on, but you can remember it. Some part of the mind is working overtime for you. Keeping track of all this stuff. that's going on. When we get into the layers of the mind, this is what we start discovering. Why does the mind go where it goes? What is it doing? Where is that terrain of the mind coming from? It's not from our intention. It's not from our thoughts. It's not even from the current books we're reading. It's not from what we think. It's not from what we believe that we know of. And yet, to the extent that we don't see what's going on in the mind at those times, those conditions, those beliefs, those assumptions, those experiences are what compels you through life. They make the decisions for you. You think you're making decisions? You're not making your decisions. Deep conditioning that we have not yet seen is making those decisions. How do we get there? Okay. So I read about this botanist back in the 1800s making his journey across the continent from East Coast to West Coast, and he was lamenting, he wrote of his journey, and he lamented the fact that he had to ride a horse, and riding a horse was, he was going so fast he missed most of what he passed. He's a botanist. He wants to look at plants. And he said, no, the journey was, it was on a horse. And he couldn't see what was going on. He could see. I mean, we drive across and it's boring. He was going on a horse and it was too fast because all he could get was like a glimpse of this plant, that plant, you know, and only a very cursory understanding of what he was seeing. So he saw very little of what was there and he understood even less. Same with us. To the extent that we think our life is a sequence of rapidly unfolding experiences, we miss most of it. We really miss it. And so most of you probably have done retreats, most have done some kind of retreat, a day-long retreat, or a week-long retreat, month-long, 3 months, something like that. What happens in a retreat like that is nothing. You know the old Gahan Wilson cartoon, two old Zen monks sitting together up on a little platform, and one is a really old, wrinkly, scowly guy. He's just kind of big, heavy set. You know, and you can tell he's been a Zen monk for about 50 years. And sitting beside him is this fresh young recruit, about 18, just like, you know, same kind of posture, same kind of uniform. And the old one is saying to the young one, what do you mean what's next? This is it. You just sit here. It's not going anywhere. Okay, I forgot what the train of thought was about here. Anyway, as Georgia O'Keeffe says, nobody sees a flower, really. It is so small. We haven't time. And to see takes time. Like to have a friend takes time. Mindfulness practice is learning to befriend ourselves, to spend time with ourselves. And when we slow down as we do on retreats, and we just spend this totally languid, unscheduled time to just be with the unfolding of the present moment experience of this mind-body continuum, we can finally get to touch. I mean, really touch what it means to experience, well, the breath. What it means, what it feels like to really touch the emotion. You know, we've all been sad, we've all been fearful, we've all been excited, we've all been joyful, ecstatic, and things like that. But if you had to actually, in your own mind, even if you tried to use words or not, describe the difference between, the experiential difference between frustration and disappointment, could you say anything meaningful? Most of us cannot. We've had that experience, or maybe I should say, those experiences or those emotions have had us. But have we really tasted these experiences of life? And it takes getting close. It takes really getting intimate. Mindfulness can do that. But we need to slow down. We need to spend time in the same place. I was in the monastery for 5 years. Got to the monastery, looked at the schedule, wake up at 3, sit and walk alternate hours till 11 o'clock at night, do that forever. That's it. You've been there one day, that's all you're going to do. As long as you stay there, that's it. And you have one little breakfast snack at 5:30 in the morning and you have your full final meal of the day at 10:30, good luck. That's it. It is so boring. There's a couple of annual events, you know, that you got to get through. You know, ceremony here, ceremony there, and things like that. Wow, what a distraction that is. It's wonderful. But, you know, what happens when you do nothing new and exciting is you finally take a look at what is so ordinary. Okay, most of you here are at least 20 or older. How many times have you gone to the toilet in this lifetime? Right? How many times have you paid attention? You know how many more times you got to go to the toilet or brush your teeth or take a shower? You know, we complain we don't have time to meditate. Our lives are too full. If you go to the toilet every day, you got time to meditate. Right? That's where we do it because it's most 90% of our life, more, is routine, ordinary, mundane, boring, familiar stuff. The challenge for us in practice is to get really interested in the mundane, ordinary, boring stuff. And what do we see when we do that? Well, we cut down, we get down through the chatter of this is my day schedule, blah, 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 and we get into actually experiencing the physical, mental, emotional terrain of the heart. Oh, yeah. Years ago, I went to visit a friend who was a cook on an archaeological dig up in central Maine behind Katahdin, which is the northern end of the Appalachian Trail. And it's an area of Maine that is just solid forest with a few ponds and a few little cabins on the ponds. And it's really remote. It's desolate. There's nothing out there except trees and things that hang out around trees. So went to this to visit her, and there was an archaeological dig, and around one of the many hundreds of ponds there, little ponds, there was this 4x4 plots marked out around this little pond, no other signs of human habitation around, and they were archaeologically excavating these 4x4 plots. And what they do is they scrape the soil off a millimeter at a time, recording everything they find. And when something unique, you know, a piece of charred wood, a little bone chip or whatever is located, they plot it out where it is, how far down, where it is in the thing, and they collect it in little plastic bags, take it back to the lab, and after months of research and cataloging and kind of figure out what it is, they came to realize that they were finding turtle bones and remnants of old campfires from that area of Maine that were 10 to 12,000 years old. And they confirmed that by the pollen, the core samples from the bottom of the pond, the pollen samples of what kind of plants were growing then. And the last glacier left Maine 10 to 12,000 years ago. So what they found out is that the the Clovis people, who are the antecedents of the Native Americans, were following the receding edge of the glacier as it receded north over Maine. And at that particular place, they found this kind of stone called chert, which Native Americans use for arrowheads, knives, spear points, and things like that. They have since found that chert, that kind of stone, all throughout the United States. Different Native American tribes would harvest it there and trade it all the way across America. So this story unfolded from the collection of little pieces of stone, little pieces of bone, little pieces of charred firewood that were, you know, a couple of feet, 2 or 3 feet in the ground. A lot of our practice is archaeologically like that. You know, when you just sit in the same spot over and over and over again, and you just look at this mind just churning away, this body doing its thing, you can't help but notice little pieces of stone, little pieces of charred wood, little pieces of bone. And what I mean is just little remnants of thoughts and memories and plans and emotions and intuitions and stuff that in and of itself is kind of insignificant. But somehow the mind takes all these pieces, these little things, these things that we notice with mindful awareness, and it makes and puts together an archaeological history of this personality. You know, we know. We get down through, we get down into the layers of our family of origin conditioning. If you haven't uncovered that yet, just you wait. You know, it's not all pleasant, believe me. But anyway, nevertheless, it's all recorded here. This mind is a perfect camcorder. Perfect. It has recorded everything. Every sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, sensation, and thought, fantasy, memory, plan, everything that has ever passed through this mind is available and accessible through mindfulness. Your mind has not forgotten a thing that ever happened to you, even if you can't remember it. And when you keep looking in this same spot at this mind, you're going to find it. You're going to find out some of the roots of your personality and the way you are in the world that you never imagined. Stress reduction, for mindfulness-based stress reduction, is great. But at that level of investigation, it's not stress reduction. It is stress manifesting. Okay. So anyway, as Carl Sagan, again, my favorite, one of my favorites, you have to know the past to understand the present. Sam Keen, another one of my favorites. To break the spell of the ego, I must recover my personal and political history. I must demythologize the private, the family, and the public myths that have informed me. I must be willing to become disillusioned with my sense of myself. And to know myself, I must begin to discriminate between my raw experiences and my myths I live by. Mindfulness is excavating the raw experiences of life to really taste these. Not what we think about our experiences, not how we believe them to be, not what we've been culturally taught them to mean, but what the raw experience itself is. Because only then can we demythologize our sense of ourself and come to really inhabit this being, this place, now. Another one of my favorite teachers of the last century, Don Juan and Carlos Castaneda, says something of the same sort. As we are exploring these rather opaque layers of the of conditioning in the mind, the family conditioning, the culture conditioning, the class conditioning, our educational conditioning, our religious conditioning, political heritage conditioning, all of these things that we grew up with are still in there, jerking us around. Don Juan, in speaking to Carlos Castaneda, says, "You see," he went on, "we have only two alternatives. We either take everything for granted, or we don't. If we follow the first, we end up bored to death with ourselves and with everyone else. If we follow the second and erase personal history, we create a mist around us, a very exciting and a mysterious state in which nobody knows where or when the rabbit will pop out." It's true. We have developed this narrative. We have created this narrative of our life, weaving every experience that we remember into the narrative of who I am. But that's just a story about what happened. And a lot of what happened, we didn't really see all that clearly because there wasn't that much mindfulness. But we got a story about it that we believe. Mindfulness in recovering, in looking at that story, in recovering that memory, is going to see things without the mythology about that story or about that experience. And we see this experience raw. we can't help but disassemble, disaggregate this composite thing called me. And there's this whole, as I mentioned, these whole archaeological layers of conditioning from our culture, from our family, religion, class, education, economic strata, all that. But somewhere, you know, below that archaeological dig that they were doing in Central Maine, somewhere down below all of this kind of human artifacts and the organic matter that had accumulated over the last 10, 12,000 years, somewhere down there, the archaeologists knew that there was bedrock, right? So we can trust that if we keep going in here, down deep, in below the layers of cultural conditioning, we're going to hit bedrock. The bedrock of this being. And that bedrock of the earth feels like pretty solid, pretty, it's there, it's not moving, it's, well, in California it moves sometimes, but, or we could say it kind of shifts a little bit, but it's still pretty solid stuff. And there is this sense that there is a bedrock within our own being, that there's a bottom which doesn't fall out. There's something essential, eternal, enduring in here, beneath all of that cultural, family, emotional conditioning. And when we get down there and we start rummaging around in it, what we find is the layer of conditioning that is imposed or structured into this entity we call ourselves through our gender, our ethnic heritage, our age, our species. Most of us never get to look at this. Well, certainly not. I mean, there's more of it coming into view because more people are practicing. But species, have you ever seen the conditioning imposed on this mind in your life by thinking of yourself as a human being? Not many. Not many of us have. But it's just conditioning. It's just ideas that we have, mythology that we have overlaid on experiences that the mind can observe that call it human, human instinctual, human innate, inherent. It's not human. It's not human. But to find that layer of conditioning and to see through it, to see that, oh, this is just a layer of myth about who and how we are. Then we get down to bedrock. Now we're down to bedrock, and you know, we think, as I said, geologically, that bedrock is pretty solid stuff. But there's this interesting phenomena going on in Hawaii. You know, these tectonic plates of the earth, they kind of move around, you know, they're kind of bumping into each other, and up come the Himalayas, and up come the Rockies, and you know, there's things like that going on. Even though bedrock is solid, they still float around, and they have dramatic impact, even though they move pretty slow. You know, bedrock moves at the, these big tectonic plates move at the rate your fingernail grows. But you know how long your fingernail would be in a lifetime? Or let's say 100 million years. That's a long fingernail. That's a lot of tectonic plate movement. Well, so too. In Hawaii, you know, there's this string of islands that runs from the northwest, the oldest islands, to the southeast, the youngest islands, like the Big Island, which is still being formed by this molten magma from the center of the earth that is coming up through a crack in the earth's mantle upon which the tectonic plates float. And so we have this evolving, recurring, growing of, well, new addition to the tectonic plate. Okay, and it's coming from this heat source in the center of the earth that is currently just a big liquid mess. It's hot, it's liquid, but it's unformed and it hasn't come to the surface. Well, let's look inside our own mind and experience and kind of use that analogy to discover what's going on in here, reflective of what's going on out there. Okay, so we got these tectonic plates, the rock bottom, solid identity of species, gender, ethnic heritage, things like that. And yet there's little cracks in it, little cracks in it. And up from the bottom, or whatever is below that, seeps this liquid material that is not yet formed, that is somehow contributing to this solid basis that we think we are. What are we talking about? We're talking about what in the Buddhist psychology is called mental legacies. They're the impersonal forces of wholesome forces and unwholesome forces and attributes of being that are not culturally or ethnically or species-wise conditioned at all. And yet they are a legacy, a mental legacy, that each one of us is born with. You know, many of us have had kids. You know, kids come into the world and they're all nice little babies. And, you know, even within a few days, you can recognize they got different personalities. They got different energies. They're not the same. We're not clones of each other when we come out of the womb and kind of enter the world. There's a lot of pre-programmed personality basis structure there. Right? Even before mom and dad say a thing to condition them into being nice little Stevie boy, you're a nice little boy, Steve, you know, or whatever your name is, which we, you know, if anybody asks you your name, do you ever doubt what it is? No, but that's not your name. That's what your parents called you, right? That's what you've kind of taken on, right? Okay, so what is, you know, the Zen koan, what is your face before you were born? Pointing to the same layer of conditioning that these mental legacies, the bedrock that seems so solid but is actually being created anew in places in our life. We're talking about the forces, the wholesome forces like the paramis, you know, generosity, morality, loving kindness, renunciation, resolve, equanimity, truthfulness. I can never remember all 10. But there is a default setting of all of these paramis within each one of us when we're born. But there's also a default setting of all of the, what are called the latent torments, you know, the anusya kilesa, the latent torments, you know, wrong views, greed, aversion of different sorts. Also, a default setting of that within this mind that takes form in a human being. And there are there's six in the Buddhist psychology, six arenas of mental legacy that we all come into this world with. Now, it's kind of like, you know, you heard about this default mode network? You know, the neuroscientists finding this default mode network, you know what that is? It's like when you're just kind of like relaxed, kind of spaced in, not doing any external task, not even doing a thinking task, your mind just settles down into this place called default mode network. It gets turned on, right? And it's what your mind does when you're not when you don't have to do anything else, when you're not doing any intentional cognitive work or anything like that. Your mind just settles down. And scientists used to think, oh, the mind just kind of goes dormant, kind of goes asleep, everything kind of into a quiescent state, just kind of like numb. But that's not what's going on. Actually, the mind gets more lit up, more alive, more, well, the potential of the mind responding to whatever conditions arise in the world is just kind of highly charged and ready. The mind is ready for anything. The mind is really active in its most quiescent state. Huh. Well, that's the default mode network of the brain that they're finding out. But it's actually the default mental legacy that we're born with that the Buddhist personality types emerge from, which, by the way, is what I'm going to be working with this afternoon, identifying the different default mode parameters of our mental legacies. working with them to identify our person, that Buddhist personality type. And then I have a whole list of Buddhist practices or spiritual practices that are effective for addressing all of the different Buddhist personality types. So if you want to play in that little workshop this afternoon, find out who you really are down below your personality, then come along. We'll have some fun. It's going to be fun, actually. Anyway, where was I? Oh, yeah, I'm down at the default mode network, bedrock. Okay, what are these things coming up to form the new bedrock? Well, the new bedrock, the mental legacy, is being formed by how we respond and react to the different opportunities to be to cultivate wholesome mind and activities or unwholesome mind and activities. And even though in the course of a lifetime it might seem like, wow, we're born with a personality, we kind of tinker with it a little bit, but basically we check out with the one we came in with. But not so. A lifetime of Dharma practice. I mean, why do we do Dharma practice anyway? Why do we keep coming to practice mindfulness? Why do we keep coming to retreats? Why do we study? Why do we do that? Because we see the benefit. We see how it really does impact the way we live our life. Yeah, well, whatever you can get in a day, you can lose in a day. Whatever you can get in a week-long retreat, you can lose in a week of not retreat. You know, so there's no end. If you practice for 20 years and then you don't practice for 20 years, you end up where you started. Maybe worse. Okay. So clearly, this path of awakening is a one-way journey. It's like once you enter this bamboo tube like a snake, there's no going back. Think about it. Once you become aware of something in yourself, how are you going to forget? How are you going to stop being aware? And what we're doing with mindfulness is actually learning how to be aware. What we're aware of is going to change endlessly, right? Momentarily, just changing all the time. But once we learn how to be aware and how to accommodate all that we're aware of, there's no end. So as my teacher, Sayadaw Tejaniya, says, it would be better to consider mindfulness and the development of wisdom a marathon rather than a sprint, which is kind of contrary to our conditioning, which is like, I want something now, I mean yesterday. You know, I want it already over with. And that's not the way it works here. But a lifetime of practice of being aware is going to dramatically, well, like the Himalayas. You know, those two tectonic plates are coming together, and three, I think, crashing together and forming the Himalayas. A lifetime of Dharma practice is like that. Your Dharma practice is meeting your mental legacies. And what you check out with is what you'll check in next time with. Think of it that way. Right? You know what I'm talking about? You know, we're all rehearsing for the great retirement. You know, and some of us seem like we're closer than the others. Like the far horizon is getting closer and closer. You know, and what's it going to be like? Anybody know? Anybody remember their past life? Anybody remember what it was like to die or be reborn? You know, just the stream of consciousness that just seems to be going on and on and on and on and on. Does it ever stop? Does it stop at death? How do we know? Better not take any chances with that. Right? So anyway, I'm losing track here. I'm going to run out of time. I'm only on page 2 of 6. God. Okay, I got through the mental legacies. Okay. Oh, right. Here we are again. Oh, yeah. Where does all this liquid magma, where does all this liquid magma from the center of the earth come from? You know, we think, oh, down there somewhere there's just this, well, big furnace, right? It's just kind of like churning out lava that comes to the surface and makes more land, you know. And by the way, you can buy new land on Maui, I mean on a big island, you know, just being formed underwater. It's black and hard right now, but give it a couple centuries and there'll be things growing there. Anyway. Same thing is happening with us in our mind. There's constantly opportunities arising in the mind to either respond wholesomely or to react through deeply conditioned patterns of reactivity, unwholesomely. And so we're constantly working on our bedrock, really. But as in the center of the earth, everything in there is stardust. everything out here is stardust. Everything that exists is just remnants of an exploding star. Everything. Really? Unbelievable. You're stardust? You're stardust? Me too. And in some sense, when you grok it, that at that level of conditioning, I don't want to say we're all the same. That doesn't sound right, does it? You know, but we're all made of the same stuff. Carl Sagan again says, the cosmos is within us. We are all made of star stuff, everything about it. I got a minute to wrap up here. This is the punchline. This is the takeaway, okay? Got to take something away from this. Okay. So for those who have seen more deeply into this whole process than I, and I'm just repeating stories I've heard, the prevailing view that is most useful is this. No matter how much happiness and sorrow is experienced. Now think about it. Think about the most happy moments of your life. The joy, the happiness, the pleasure, the excitement, the ecstasy, the bliss, the whatever it is. I don't know what it is for you, but, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll, dharma, enlightenment. You know, take your pick. You know, I don't know, maybe you like vegetarian food. I don't know, whatever it is. But anyway, no matter how much... what?
A bowl of soup.
Soup? What kind?
Vegetable soup.
Yeah, that's a good choice. Okay. So anyway, no matter how much happiness... Now think about all the sorrow. God, is there anybody here that hasn't experienced heartbreak, loneliness, fear, shame, humiliation? I mean, we've been through the freaking mill, right? We've been through it. You know, none of us escapes this human life without a tremendous amount of sorrow. Right? The loss of everything. Right? Here's the takeaway. No matter how much happiness and sorrow is experienced, isn't it amazing that this mind is never impaired nor improved in the slightest? Really? I mean, think about it. The mind that experiences sorrow does the same thing in knowing happiness. The mind itself is not affected one bit. It's not improved. The mind doesn't get better at knowing an experience. It doesn't get impaired by knowing sorrow. The mind just keeps knowing. That's our common heritage. That's what we could discover at the bottom of this looking. When we look at this place in this time, right now, deeply, that's what we discover. Everything is changing. Nothing is changing. This mind, this heart, is not changing one bit. It's experiencing everything. Right? What did I have on page 6? Oh, yeah, wait. One more takeaway. Hold it. You know, all that exploding stardust, this whole universe out there is just kind of like expanding forever, and there's more space than there is stuff. And then there's the black stuff. Wow, there's even more of that than there is the visible stuff. But anyway, Carl Sagan again. In all of our searching, the only thing we found that makes the emptiness bearable is each other. And as Trungpa Rinpoche reminds us, such a precious human body, difficult to rediscover. Such precious pain, not difficult to discover. Such an old story is by now a familiar joke. You and I know the facts and the case history. We have a mutual understanding of each other, which has never been sold or bought by anyone. Our mutual understanding keeps the thread of sanity Sometimes the thread is electrified. Sometimes it's smeared with honey and butter. Nevertheless, we have no regrets. And since I am here, seemingly you are here too, let's practice. Sitting is a jewel that ornaments our precious life. Thank you very much. If you want to discover your mental legacy and what you can do about it, somewhere this afternoon, 1 to 4, 1 to 3, 1 to 4:30, I think. We'll have a little worksheet where you can fill in the blanks, and at the end of the day, you'll see your mental personality, your Buddhist personality type right there. And on the back will be all of the practices that you can undertake to kind of improve what's good about it and kind of address what is limiting about it. Okay. Enjoy your day. Lunch, whatever it is that's next. Hi, Hugh.